Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey guys, Lynn here from Too Complicated for History. Today we're doing a fee drop from our last guest, Dr. Michael Patrick Coulinane, and his podcast titled The Gilded Age and Progressive Era. Today's episode is called Dressed for Freedom, and it looks at feminism and the politics of women's fashion with Dr. Inev Rabinovich Fox. This episode is a fascinating topic, and the Gilded Age and Progressive Era looks at many topics relevant to our modern age, such as exciting new technologies, large class inequalities, questioning our place in the world, I know I've certainly done that, divisive politics, volatile economies. These are all compelling topics, right? Well, if you want to know more about today, it really helps to know we've been here before. So go check out the Gilded Age and Progressive Era podcast. But for now, sit back and enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, a podcast about the United States and the world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm your host, Michael Patrick Coulinane. Welcome back to the show. We've often been told to dress for success, although in the same breath, I think we've also heard the saying that we should put substance over style. So which one is it? Maybe it's both. In the Gilded Age, fashion changed markedly, as it does today. Just as we do today, back then, people made fashion statements with their clothes. Women, in particular, made fashion an expression of politics, much like we do today. You could think of Melania Trump's pussy bow blouse, Hillary Clinton's many pantsuits, or in 2022, at the Met Gala, Camila Cabello wore an upcycled dress, which was clearly a statement about the environment. In short, fashion matters. And today, I'm joined by Inev Rabinovich Fox, who teaches at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and she specializes in U.S. women's history. Today, we're speaking about her book, Dressed for Freedom, American Feminism and the Politics of Women's Fashion. Welcome to the show, Inev.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We're here to talk about your super book, Dressed for Freedom, which makes the case for fashion and for clothing specifically as a material culture that's charged with political meaning. So I'm just going to open it up to you. What does fashion tell us about feminism that things like, say, the Seneca Falls Convention or the 19th Amendment can't tell us about feminism?
Sure. Clothes are clothes matter, right? We see it all around us. They are very like any other, form of historical source. They are a way to get into the past, and I think because we all wear clothes, right? It's something that is very tangible, and it's a way to communicate ideas in a very kind of like immediate way. Oftentimes, even before we speak to a person, right? Before we hear their accent or how they speak, we form an opinion about them, right? From what we see, how they dress and how they look like. So it's something that I think, you know, for many of us, it's very unconscious way of looking at the world. And we all kind of like, oh, we all wear clothes. We all understand clothes. But I think like any other, form of communication, it is something that we need to learn and we need to learn to decipher. But it's something that can be used in ways that because we all wear clothes, right, we can all make those statements through appearance. And that's something that, especially if you work with women or that, you know, historically did not leave us a lot of written records, or with populations that, again, do not leave written records or did not have access to power. Clothes was a very useful way to make those statements and to convey those ideas. So when we think about feminism and women's rights in particular, I think when we look at fashion, we can look at a lot of other groups and not just the middle-class women who came to Seneca Falls and, you know, worked in the suffrage movement, although, you know, I have a chapter in the book on the suffragists. They were very savvy with their clothes. But it does give us kind of like a window to other groups or marginalized groups that not necessarily left records. But it also, I think, and even more important, allows us to think about feminism and women's rights as an everyday practice and not as something that is very kind of like very in the legal form or kind of like very far away from us. But it is that you practice and you are being a feminist doesn't mean, you know, kind of like writing a lot of books about it, but also kind of like this everyday practice of what does it mean to be feminist? What does it mean to think about those issues? And clothes, because we all wear them, allows to do that.
I think that's a great answer. And I think obviously there's that unspoken, it is literally unspoken, it's material culture. So it's not written or oral. And maybe you could give us a few examples of times when fashion trends or styles facilitated feminist politics. And what I mean by that is, like, did fashion bring feminism into the mainstream public discourse? Or are there other examples that you want to give? But in your own sort of like research, how does fashion lead to, you know, public questions of equal rights and feminism in particular?
Yeah, so I mean, and that's a great question. And I think that, right, when we often do think about feminism and fashion, it's like the Roman Empire, right? I think about it all the time. But for people who don't think about fashion and feminism all day long, I think the most kind of like famous example is the bloomer costume, which was actually a very notoriously outrageous costume at the time. It was worn by Amelia Bloomer. This is how it got the name, but also Elizabeth Cady Stanton and other kind of like very prominent women's rights advocate, and it became very associated with the struggle for suffrage and for women's rights. And what was so outrageous about this dress was that it included pants, and in the mid-19th century, that was a very big challenge to the gender hierarchy and gender norms, because women were not supposed to wear pants. Pants was very much associated with masculinity. And it was a flop. It was, you know, it didn't work. It wasn't successful. It didn't came into the mainstream. And it actually was used as a backlash and as a trope against feminist for a long time, way, way long after they abandoned that outfit. And partly as a way kind of like, oh, you see all those feminists, these are crazy women who are, you know, trying to become men, who are trying to kind of like destroy the world and to make it upside down. Right? Because look, they ugly, they wear pants, they're masculine. And it became kind of like, right, a way to really attack feminists. So by the 20th century, feminists were like, we don't want to be associated with the bloomers. This does not help us and does not help us to promote the cause. And they were really thinking about, right, we need, and especially in the suffrage struggle, because they need to convince men to give them the vote at the end of the day. How do we do it? And part of it was about presenting a fashionable, a beautiful feminine image that will see, you know, we want to be equal, but we're not a threat to society. So kind of like by using this fashion, and for them, you know, luckily for them, fashion industry, because of capitalism, because of technology, because of kind of like the rise of kind of like a ready-to-wear industry, that's how we today buy clothes, but you know, that we go to the store and we buy clothes that we didn't make. But that really becomes kind of like very popular in the end of the 19th century, early 20th century. So the fashion industry is also looking for way to make a lot of clothes cheaply. So in a way, they also kind of like in favor of simplifying silhouettes, of making clothes more comfortable, because this, you know, costs less money to make those type of clothes, and they can make more money out of it. So feminists are kind of like, by the 20th century, are really able to show them, like, look, we are also with the trends, right? We are dressing with the trends. The shirt waist, which is kind of like a form of like the feminine version of the male blouse, is really kind of like, this is the first bestseller for women. And also the first really mass-made garment for women. And that kind of like shows very kind of like, it's both professional, it both kind of like very neat looking, but on the other hand, it's mobile, it's modern, it's kind of like for on-the-go woman, that really does kind of like aligns with the argument that feminists make of, yes, we do need to be able to move and to breathe and to kind of like go out and about for work, for education. So that really kind of like fits into this idea of feminist arguments. And later on, I think, you know, in the 1920s, and kind of like this idea of the flapper with the short skirt, with kind of like this idea of liberation, that was really kind of like, and was very interpreted this way by the public, of like, see, this is what happened when women get the vote and women are being freed. And they're freed not only in the political realm, in the terms that now they can vote, with all the caveats, right, that the 19th century, the 19th Amendment did or did not do, but the flapper with her short skirt, with her, you know, very free lifestyle of smoking and dancing and kind of like what we think of as the roaring 20s, really symbolized this idea of a freedom, of liberation, that is not just about political rights, but it's also about freeing your own body. It's about, you know, ability to go and to move in ways that was really for the first time in history. People were like, oh, women have two legs and they can actually use them, right? So really, to think about, even to think about this, and even, you know, it's small things, but, and you know, you don't have hair on your head, so you might not be so aware of it, but hair weighs a lot, clothes weighs a lot. And what the 1920s did was really to make clothes, to make the weight of clothes and hair just irrelevant. And it really, I mean, you know, and everybody wants to, you know, wake up next morning without 10 pounds on their body, but that was the feeling for many women. So it's a very tangible, it's not like, you know, an abstract idea of freedom. And it, that change, it wasn't overnight, but, you know, sometimes it was very quick. So for a woman who was 15 in 1905, you know, by the time she's, you know, 35 in 1925, she would have lost almost 10 pounds from just hair and clothes, because she would have cut her hair. And that's, you know, that's 3-4 pounds just the hair, and it's not on your head all the time. I mean, so just this tangible feeling of freedom and kind of like lightweightness is something that I think, you know, and many women were really kind of like feeling it in a very literally sense. So I think we shouldn't underestimate how much that change was because, you know, yes, voting is great, but kind of like be able to go on a weekend and pack clothes that goes into a small suitcase instead of, you know, a trunk, that's a lot, that makes a lot of difference for the everyday life of women.
What I would give for 3 pounds of extra hair on my head, I know. And I'll have you know, I'll have you know, back in the day, my hair was longer than yours, believe it or not. So yes, I might be free, but I feel diminished now. I need to enhance my appearance with ridiculous costumes now, I think. But anyway, no, you're that's a wonderful explanation, wonderful examples. I want to dive into some of them, particularly the shirt waist and the flapper in a little bit more depth. But I really love that you pointed out there that fashion is not just about the clothes too. It's much more than that. It's not even just the accessories. It's the literal feeling of liberation here. So, but let's go back to the shirt waist. And I was wondering if you could do two things with the shirt waist, because you mentioned it there. It plays a really big role in your book. It's the first chapter. It's probably the biggest chapter. It's really a wonderful look at a style that transformed I think life for women over a decade. Can you describe what the shirt waist is? Because you mentioned it there briefly, and tell us how the fashion came into being and what did it do for things like race? Because you talk about how it transcended racial kind of styles. And can you tell us a little bit more about what it does for class? Because you talk about how the shirt waist kind of conforms to some norms, but then breaks out of others as well. And race and class seem to be two that it transcends and yet conforms to in certain ways as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, the shirt waist was really the first mass-made garment for women. Women's bodies are very hard to standardize or harder than males' bodies. So it really, I mean, the industry really took a while until it picked up on kind of like how to standardize clothes for women. The Civil War was a great catalyst for men clothing because the military needed uniform, right? So kind of like mass production for men clothes kind of like started to pick up after the Civil War, but it was really only in the late 19th century that kind of like the industry figured out how to do it for women. And the shirt waist was the solution, and partly because it was easier to standardize. Unlike other forms of garment, it didn't have to fit into the body really nicely. It could be kind of like quite loose. You had still had your corset beneath it, but it didn't have to fit to kind of like your own measurement. So it could have become more standardized, which, you know, gave a good reason for the industry to do it. But it also could be made in various grades. You know, if you were a rich person, you would probably let your personal dressmaker sew your shirt waist. If you were kind of like middle class, you might have gone to a very luxurious department store and bought it. And if you were a working class woman who probably would have sewed and made those shirt waist herself, she could not afford to buy the shirts that she was making, but she could have bought them in maybe the basement, the sale basement of a department store, or in a pushcart on the street, or even, you know, if she was very talented, and many of them were, She could have stealed some cloth from the factory and sew it herself. But for most working class women, it was the act of buying, right? Instead, like, I don't want to waste, you know, even though I can do it, this was their job. So they didn't want to do this on their spare time, right? They wanted to be able to buy those clothes because the act of buying was actually kind of like, for them, a way to be here. We are like middle-class women. We can also buy our clothes, right? This is kind of like a status symbol. But what's great about the shirtwaist that it had this democratic aspiration that even if the quality of the shirtwaist really varied, they looked the same. And I think, like, you know, for today's listeners, we need a way to think about it is through, you know, fast fashion of H&M and Zara, right? They're taking what we see on the runway of the Chanel, and they're kind of like making a very cheap version of the same style. And that's what happened basically with the shirtwaist. So, you know, if you're a very, if you're kind of like a fashion scholar, you can tell the difference between, between a Chanel suit and an H&M version of it. But for most people, right, those are just look the same, right? They don't look at the seams. They don't look at the, they don't feel the, you know, the quality of the fabric that is really different from grade to grade, but they look the same. So a working class woman who lives for $6 a week, right, can look like the middle class or even the very rich woman who live on Park Avenue, and they kind of like be look the same, and that has a lot of meaning in terms of like the democratization of fashion, and you can see it and garment workers especially because they're kind of like also adjacent in very kind of like tangible way to the industry. They follow fashion because they are making those fashions, you know, before they hit the store. So they know kind of like their finger is very much on kind of like what's going to be trendy and what's not going to be trendy. So they know and they find their own solution of how to keep up with that fashion. But for them, wearing those shirtwaists, it's not just a professional identity that we look respectable, we look professional, but we look like our middle class sisters. We all look American. A lot of those garment workers are immigrants, right? So that's another kind of like way for them. And the shirtwaists become very much associated with this idea of this new woman, this new American woman. The shirtwaist is not so kind of like popular in Europe. It's very much associated with the American industry. So for those immigrant women, that's another way to show, look, we are American citizens, right? That's and again, for someone who might not know English so well, or kind of like doesn't speak great English, or, you know, have different kind of foods that she's eating right at home, or have, you know, maybe she's Jewish, so she has different customs. I mean, but if she's wearing a shirtwaist, she looks like any other American. And that's kind of like often the first thing that immigrants do when they come to the country. They shed their clothes from the old world and they buy a shirtwaist because that's kind of like show that they are Americans. And you can see later on when garment workers are starting to get more militant and to strike, when they standing in the big strike of 1909, and there are rich elite women who are standing on the picket line with them in solidarity, and they're getting arrested together, right? Because, I mean, you know, Mrs. Morgan, the daughter of J.P. Morgan, is standing with those strikers, and she gets arrested. And you kind of like, who is the policeman who, you know, who dare to arrest the daughter of J.P. Morgan. But, you know, both of them look the same. So you can tell, right? Because both of them wore shirtwaist. I mean, and of course, you know, Mrs. Morgan shirtwaists were far better in quality. But this, they look the same. And that allowed for a lot of kind of like this democratization, both over class, across class, but also across race. I mean, because Black women also kind of like joining this, right? They're saying, look, this is kind of like an image that we can also tap into. And again, because it was so associated with idea of Americanism, with a collegiate culture, with kind of like this idea of respectability, for Black women, it is another kind of like easy segue to kind of like, look, we look like those white women. And if we look like those white women, we also deserve the same rights and privileges as white women, because we look like them, right? And the shirtwaist, because it was so prevalent and because it was kind of like this very professional, respectable looking type of garment, allow them to kind of like make those claims for fashionability, for respectability, that they might not be able to do in any other ways, because, you know, some of them were poor, some of them were not as wealthy. Most of them could not go into department stores and try on the clothes, because this is, right, there's segregation, there's discrimination against Black people. But on the other hand, but the shirtwaist, again, because it doesn't have to be fitted into a body, can be bought in, you know, what we call today online, right? And this is also a period where we see the rise of those trade catalogs like Sears, Montgomery Ward, that really becomes kind of like the way that people buy clothes. They buy clothes through the mail and you don't need to try it on. And Sears was very kind of like progressive in a way that did allow Black people to participate in this consumer culture in a way that was less discriminatory, right? Because you could just send your money and you got your shirtwaist in the mail. And again, you were part of this fashion conversation, even if you were not, you know, the most kind of like obvious person to participate in that conversation.
It's so powerful. And you know, this is why I love your book too. And the other half of the shirtwaist story is the bicycle skirt. And I wanted to talk about that because we're living in an age where, I don't know if we realize that we're living through this sometimes, but athletic wear, and I'm actually wearing athletic wear right now as we speak, but especially for women, athletic wear has it's not a statement anymore. It's the norm. Like students show up to your class in athletic wear. You know, it's not just for yoga or for working out. It's now every day. And the bicycle skirt is a little bit of that story too. How does that match up with the shirt waist and this like appeal to the new woman, as you call it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting, and I'm actually working on a piece about sportswear. But the category of kind of like sportswear or activewear or athleisure wear that today is a multi-billion-dollar industry, right? And we do wear it as an everyday wear. I mean, that category did not exist well into the 20th century for women's wear. Women had to figure it out, right? What to do, because women were not supposed to be engaged in physical activities. Women were not supposed to engage in sports. But what happened with the bicycle that was a craze in the, you know, late 19th century, and it was kind of like this great invention and everybody were so excited about it. And what was good about it, it was kind of like this new sport, right? It didn't have like a long tradition of excluding women. So women really picked up on the bicycle very quickly. There are those old bicycles when there's like this big wheel and then the small wheel. And that's actually very dangerous and very complicated. You know, we see it now only in the circus because it's actually very hard to ride on. But by the late 19th century, the kind of like the two wheel invention comes, the bicycle as we know it today. And women were like, oh, this is great. Like, this is a great way to exercise. But unlike other sports that are becoming kind of like popular, especially in the women's colleges, cycling was kind of like a very public activity. It wasn't just sport. People just, you know, took a ride in the park. It was a courting activity. So women couldn't just wear what they wanted. They needed, you know, if you're going out with someone, you need to dress up, right? So they had to find solutions that were A, comfortable, but also kind of like did not push too much against gender norms, because they still had to maintain kind of like this feminine appearance, even if they're wearing, you know, not sweatpants, but, you know, yeah, my students are the same there. So it's sweatpants. I don't know if they trying to impress the other sex, but cycling fashion was definitely that. And so even though bloomer was definitely an option and was probably the preferable option for riding a bike, it wasn't as, because of all its complicated history, women could not wear bloomers when they when they rode bicycles. So they kind of like came up with a compromise that was kind of like a short skirt. And when I say short, it kind of like mid-calf. So, you know, for us in the 21st century, terms of short is very different, but it was short for these women. I mean, showing of legs was considered to be very radical at the time. And when women are starting to, you know, ride those bicycles, and again, you know, there were many of them, the public got used to seeing all these women in short skirts. It's not this not normal thing anymore. And then women were like, okay, this works on the wheel. It can also work off the wheel, right? And again, when women are starting to get education, to you know, to be more in the public sphere, they need to walk around in city streets, and city streets were far more dirtier than they used to be. The short skirt was a great solution because it didn't brought all the dirt and, you know, diseases that the long skirts brought with them. And it was, again, for women, a very tangible experience. Oh my God, like for first time in my life, I'm not sick at winter because my clothes are not wet and dirty, right? And so for especially, and a bunch of kind of like career women in New York, and later it spread throughout the country, saying, look, we need those, you know, rainy day clothes. And they figure out, well, if it works on rainy days, it will work, you know, on sunny days too. Like, why not wearing it all the time? So this idea of mobility, of the idea that clothes need to be functional, right? They're not just beautiful, or we don't need just to be, you know, look at good at, but actually clothes need to serve a function. Really becomes popular through these athletics, through sports, in a way that everyday wear become kind of like similar to sportswear. But again, you still have to maintain this idea of femininity, of respectability. You know, I think a lot of women, even the most radical ones, would probably be kind of like, look at today's students and would be kind of like, oh my God, why are you wearing your pajamas to
absolutely, I'm sure they would. I think I do that sometimes too, and I'm only maybe a generation removed, but okay. Well, you, there's so much I want to pick up on there, but I'm going to save that for when we talk about New York and Bohemian styles, because I think there's some questions there about sectionalism and style in different places and where do the styles come from. But before I do that, I want to just look at the suffragette movement or the suffrage movement, which that really gained traction in popular imagination, your book points out, when they took up performance and pomp and, you know, and fashion was a part of that. So tell us what the suffrage style was, what the clothes looked like for both African-American and white suffragists. I mean, you talk about this style called the Oriental style. So maybe you can tell listeners what that was.
Yeah. Right. So in the beginning of the 20th century, I mean, although I have to admit, I mean, the fascination with the Orient or with Orientalism or the Far East has gone, you know, for many years. And it has, as in fashion, right, we have trends. So there was like a trend in the 19th century, which actually the bloomer is part of it because it is Turkish trousers, technically, that kind of like imitate the harem pants. But by the early 20th century, there is this, again, fascination with the Orient, with mainly with Japan and kind of like more that Far Eastern cultures, partly because Japan is by, you know, the early 20th century does rise as this powerful military force, a modern empire. After years of seclusion, Japan is kind of like becoming one of the kind of like global powers. So there is this fascination with that Japanese culture. But it was really, I mean, like good, you know, white imperialistic people, the adoptions from the Orient is very kind of like loose and not historically or necessarily accurate. There's also still very much a fascination with Turkey and kind of like the Middle East. So, you know, you can find in one outfit all kind of inspirations that would deem Oriental, but they're not necessarily from the same geographical space or geographical time. But there is this fascination with the Orient in a way that, you know, Edward Said also talked about, that this is kind of like this very, it's sexualized, it's very exciting, it's very feminine too, right? Unlike the Western rational kind of like seriousness that very much is associated with masculinity, the Orient is feminine, the Orient is emotional. But for women and for feminists, the Orient is also a place of freedom in some sense that they can experiment, and especially white middle-class women can afford to experiment with kind of like all kind of conventional clothes and styles, and, you know, worst thing worst, they will be Oriental, right? This is like the Oriental style. They're not going to be censored as, you know, this is not respectable or you're so they have kind of like this allow of freedom, and the style that comes, especially the kimono styles, are more comfortable, are more loose. They don't include corsets. If you look at the Middle East, also you have the pants, the harem pants, that becomes kind of like very fashionable. So kind of like feminists are really kind of like using this Oriental style and the fascination with the Oriental style to kind of like experiment with their own clothes and to find their own way of dressing in a way that will fit their own ideas of, you know, bodily freedom and freedom of movement that the kimono does allow them to do. For them, it was a way to kind of like take out something that was kind of like was supposed to be very intimate, very kind of like private form of wear and say, no, this is a, you know, this is a public outfit. But because it was in fashion, people are not looking at them as like, oh, these are crazy feminists. But they're like, oh, these are very fashionable women. Maybe we should listen to what they say. And the suffrage movement in particular was very good at understanding, you know, political, modern political campaigning. I think, you know, today we're like, oh, of course, you know, politicians need to craft an image and need to kind of like play with visuals. And a lot of this modern campaigning was actually invented and or, you know, popularized by suffragists. And they were really good in utilizing this modern technology of campaigning to push for their, you know, for their goal. And they succeeded. You know, the 19th Amendment did pass in the end. And they were very savvy about it. So they used, they knew how to use the press. They knew, again, how to build an image for who is a suffragist, right? Most of it was actually not in terms of style so much as in just colors. So the use of colors are very, very kind of like interesting in the suffrage movement because they're very intentionally using colors, right? We now know suffrage white, and that's something that, you know, we see it even in today's politicians who are using kind of like that association with the suffrage movement. But the suffrage movement really, so the three suffrage color, purple, yellow, and white are really becoming kind of like part of their campaign. And the way to do it, right, is to dress in those colors. And white dresses are just cheaper, right, to have. And also they work really well in the black and white photographs that needs to be printed in the press, right? So that contrast of color between black and white really pictures well. And suffragists are really kind of like attuned to those things. So white dresses, even though, again, they were using a more sophisticated color palette, actually, but it kind of like gets lost in the black and white evidence. And the white does make a very powerful impression. But again, and again, because it's something that everybody can wear, it does allow for kind of like a more broader solidarity or a more unifying image, even though we know there's a lot of tension between Black suffragists and white suffragists. But when they march together, all look the same. That's a powerful image. And that, you know, it doesn't override those tensions, but at least it can allow to present a more unified image. Or for Black women especially, it allows them to say, again, we look the same. We are with you in this because, you know, we are all together looking the same. So that was a very powerful thing for again Black women to claim those things that white suffragists already are claiming. And the white was especially important because white was associated with morality, with purity, which were qualities that, you know, Black women were denied in the public sphere. So for them to march in white dresses was also to claim those rights. So this is, I think, you know, why white became so powerful. But, you know, and we don't have color images, unfortunately, but there were a lot of, you know, yellows and purples too.
But it all goes to this point that these are very conscious decisions as well, that we're not just stumbling through our day to day, putting on whatever, just because it's whatever's around. We're making these conscious decisions. And one of the things that I think about when I thought about when I was reading this was about fashion centers and where are these ideas coming from? And you mentioned New York, and nowadays we would say like New York, Paris, Milan, and Tokyo, right? I mean, it would be, and maybe you could add other places to that too, but but there are sort of fashion centers, and there are stylistic differences presumably too. And maybe if I could just like restrict your answer to just the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, because I know your book goes far beyond it. But I mean, in the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, what are those centers? I presume it's New York, but maybe there's others as well that I didn't, that just didn't spring to mind.
It's actually is Paris. The center is always, and for a long, long time, is Paris. Even though that you're right, by the time, by the Gilded Age, there's enough money in New York. And New York does become, it becomes a manufacturing center for sure. The shirtwaist is, the industry at the time is in New York, the Lower East Side, in particular, as the 20th century will progress, it will move to the South and then to the global South. But in the, 19th century, early 20th century, the garment industry center is still New York. Chicago is another very big center, again, because it's a center of money, but also a center of immigrants and industry. Cleveland, where I am from, is also have a lot of centers. But these are not necessarily fashion centers. There are manufacturing centers, right, where industry happens. Styles are still coming very much from Paris. It will only be in the later and the mid 20th century where styles will really become, when New York would be kind of also an originator of styles and not just of clothes, right? So, and by the Gilded Age, the very rich, the Vanderbilts, the Esters of the world, they will get their fashions and their dresses from Paris, from the Paris couturiers. And that's interesting because, again, dressed is capital. We are now wearing fast fashion and it's hard to think about clothes as like very expensive, but clothes were very expensive and they were a form of capital and they were very, when there was a tariff war between US and France, a lot of angry women in New York are calling their husbands and they were like, what the hell is happening? We need our worth dress and I don't want to pay an extra $600 for it. right. So women are very much involved in kind of like this very serious conversation about capitalism through their engagement with fashion. So the very elite does still goes to Paris, 2-3 times a year, being measured, going and being and have their dress sewn to a person, right? It is Worth maybe or other French designers, but they are dressed for a certain person. The kind of like the middle class or kind of like, right, people who are less financially wealthy, they will probably get their clothes either imported from Paris or being sewn in America, but on based on a French design. So what happened is that, a buyer from a department store will go to a fashion show in Paris, will see, okay, this is the trends of the season. And then he will buy, or she will buy a few dresses that are kind of like French originals, right? And then the department store will sell those as French originals. But they will also go to a dressmaker in Brooklyn and say, you see this dress? I want this dress in like the $40 mark, in the $150 mark, in the $20 mark. So we will have the same dress in a different prices that would probably be made in the United States, but the fashion would come from Paris. So yeah, and for kind of like, you know, other like places like Chicago, San Francisco, St. Louis, these women or the elites in those places will maybe, I mean, some of them will go to Paris as well, but some of them will go to New York, right? And will buy those Paris fashions. So it is kind of like this trickling down of styles, but very much until the Second World War, Paris will be the capital.
Yeah, and I presume it still thinks of itself in that way too, although your one of your later chapters in the 1940s and 50s talks about female designers in the United States as well. And that's a really, really great story of empowerment through that industry. I'm not going to ask about that, although I would encourage readers to go pick up the book and get to those chapters about the 1920s and the flapper, which you mentioned, about the women that are working in the industry, the design industry. But I wanted to ask you about the research, because I imagine that that must have been a lot of fun, if not really frustrating at times, because you've got original sources like the designs and the outfits, and that must have been great to like find and explore. But then you have to get to what you're talking about in some of these answers that you're giving me about like the motives for style and the impression that these styles would have made on other people. And that seems rather difficult to find at times. Am I right?
Yes. Unfortunately, most of us do not write a manifesto, right? Why, when they get dressed up, you know, in the morning, right? So it was really hard to find those smoking guns of like, oh, today I wore this dress because I wanted to show my support for whatever. So I didn't have, I have like one or two of those, but I don't really have, because again, most of us are not doing it, right? So it was hard sometimes to get into kind of like, okay, but why are you really wearing those things? Fortunately, you know, some of the women did write about it. I was actually quite surprised. You know, when I started this research, I was also kind of like, how do I get into it? So, and it took a while, but kind of like, I don't remember which one, but I remember reading an article that also said that that kind of like how this author came to this subject, that she kind of like put aside every time that someone talked about fashion, because like, this was not the thing that she's working on. And after a while, she was like, oh my God, I have a pile. So maybe I should do something with that. And it was really something that for me was helpful. I was like, okay, let me just, you know, try to build those piles. So it's a line here and it's a line there. But in the end, I had a pile that I could work with, which was, you know, which meant reading a lot of fashion magazines, which, you know, I think for a lot of people might sound like fun. But for me, at one point, I was like, yeah, this is not fun anymore. I think everything that people like do away from their research, like for me, it was research. And now I kind of like, now it's work. Like I don't, for me, it's not like this escapist thing that you do after.
Oh, I totally get it. I absolutely get it.
It's like, what do you do? I read Vogue all day, but it's like really work. It's really hard at one point. So it was about kind of like combing a lot of women's magazines, and which was actually for me, it was surprising to see how much, not just women's magazines, but you know, newspapers like the New York Times, like The Nation, very like serious, right? Publication really had a lot of talk about fashion in very political, interesting ways. So I was kind of like actually surprised to find so much of kind of like, oh, they actually do talk a lot about this. This is not a frivolous thing that they don't think about. Which kind of like also led me to see why it was intentional in many ways. And it's not just like, oh, let's just pick up the dress in the closet and go out to the street. But another thing, and that was also interesting to compare what was in the papers to actual garments, because when you touch something and when you see it, you really got the sense of like, oh my God, this is heavy. This does not look so comfortable. There's a lot of debate about women's waists and corsets. But when you see a dress, you're kind of like, oh, this is actually not that narrow of a waist. Like if people were also shorter, in the 19th century. So it's kind of like proportional. It's not as, narrow or extreme as sometimes what you read in kind of like anti-corset literature. So it does give you a good sense of kind of like the difference between, and it is the age before photography really became kind of like prevalent in magazines. So there's a lot of illustrations, and illustrations are not necessarily comparable to real life. Not that photography is, but that was very helped me also to get a sense of kind of like what comfort really means. And for me, like the most interesting example was when I was at Smith College and I got to see their costume collection, and they had a swimming suit from the 20s, which was kind of like this very radical type of design, like because it showed the legs and showed the arms. And when I looked at it, it was made out of wool. And I was like, I would have never, like, you pay me, I don't wear. Like, this is the most, I can't believe people wore it and even celebrate this as like freedom. Like, I don't want to, like, no, just no. And it's something that, a picture would never have given that me that, because all those women, right, look so happy. And I was like, all I could think about was like, this is like a wet wool on your body. Like, how
it's like torture, be scratching you. Yeah, as you're swimming. I know. It's terrible. Yes. Yeah.
So,
yeah. I love that you do have to kind of, as much as possible, get your hands on, the objects of the past in order to get closer to it. I completely agree. The book takes us right up to the recent past, the 1980s and later waves of feminist activity. But I wonder if we could take the story to the 2010s and 2020s, where we are today. And for me, I couldn't help but think about Melania Trump, actually, and her decision to wear the Pussy Boat blouse after that audio was released of her husband then running for president, where he talks about sexually assaulting women. But the press had said that her decision to wear the blouse was an act of defiance. We might never know, of course, whether that's true or not, but it does seem evocative about, in a way, how your book positions material culture in the public debates over equality and power. And I was wondering if you had any other recent examples of fashion and feminism that might offer us some similar takes, like the Melania Trump one.
Sure. I mean, I would be hesitant to call Melania Trump feminist, but...
Well, like I said, we'll never know with that.
We'll never know. I mean, yeah. I actually think she's far less defiant that the media is making her to be. I think, and it's interesting in the recent, we are in the midst of a campaign, of an election campaign. And I was like thinking, actually, yes, I mean, there was a GOP primaries debate yesterday. And I've been thinking a lot about Nikki Haley in the last couple of months. I think actually that Nikki Haley has not found her style yet. She's experimenting with all kind of looks. None of them actually works well for her, I think. And she has a very difficult thread to thread, because she needs to look powerful, and she's a woman of color in a Republican Party. So she's trying to find her way. I think it's a problem for her that we're in January and she doesn't have an image yet. But
she does talk about her stilettos, right? When Vivica Ramaswamy asked her,
right. But she capitalize or harness those. She's still kind of like, I think, very much afraid to talk about her appearance. I mean, I think like if we compare it to Hillary Clinton, especially in 2016, Hillary Clinton really kind of like owned the pantsuit, made her own, and really kind of like said, yes, this is my fashion, and really kind of like embraced kind of like the fashion discourse as part of kind of like her woman card that she was far more comfortable in using in 2016 compared to 2008. So Clinton was far kind of like better in using fashion to make a statement. I think, you know, the younger generation of congresswomen, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and even Ilhan Omar, right? They have now, not to mention Sinema.
Kyrsten Sinema, from Arizona. Right.
Yeah, that they are really understand, you know, you can argue with their politics, but they really understand the power of imagery and the power of clothes in making those images. And they're really using it in very, very clever ways, I feel, in really understanding that, yeah, that sometimes, again, you form your opinion way before these women are starting to make their speeches. And their clothes can say a lot of things. So they're very clever about using this. I mean, and interestingly, what I find is really how much the suffrage white that was kind of like, you know, we started to see it around the centennial, but now it kind of like became the official uniform of women in politics. I mean, they all wear white and become like, you cannot sworn into office not wearing white. And I think that also says a lot about, you know, the suffrage movement and how much of that legacy is still with us. But also how today's politicians, and you know, on the spot, not just women, men use it too. Justin Jones from Tennessee, who was one of the three state congressmen who got expelled, he wore also a white suit to the day of his hearing, right? In a very intentional way, referencing the suffrage movement. So it's really interesting how much of that kind of like history is really part of our current fashion discourse, especially in politics, that I find really interesting and fascinating, and how much of it became kind of like the way to make a statement, to make a protest. And you know, during the State of the Union addresses, during the Trump administration, when all Democratic Congresswomen appeared in white, that was a very powerful statement. And they did reference, you know, now we're living in a Twitter age. So I do get a lot of tweets about women's clothing, far more than the original document. But really thinking about that and how clothes is important to what you say. And I think, you know, part of Nikki Haley's struggle is because she couldn't find a good, like she hasn't found yet like a good image that she can really tap on and kind of like sell, because we don't, like, I don't know how she's gonna wear.
I suppose the counterpart to that is maybe Sarah Palin, who quickly found an image as, you know, this sort of hyper feminine, rustic, you know, backwoods person, you know, like, yeah. You know, I see what you mean. Nikki Haley hasn't adopted it, but you could tell that she wants to. I mean, she talks about it, you know, when she came back to Vivek Ramaswamy and said, you know, they're not as big as you might think, you know? And
yeah,
but so you can tell she's trying to. What about the Met Gala is another political platform that seems to be, I suppose the Met Gala has always been a thing, but it seems in the last few years, the fashion has become even more politicized, especially around women's rights, trans rights, gay and lesbian rights.
Yes, I think, I mean, part of it was, I think the Met came with relatively political exhibitions, which, you know, is not common for the Met, but they did it. They had the American style exhibition, and it was kind of like a double exhibition. So that, I think, got more political attention, right? But I think what in the Met Gala, you can really see how fashion can be, you know, just fashion. It's not just, you know, beautiful clothes, right? And even if you make a statement on Chanel, right, the way they did in the Karl Lagerfeld show, I mean, that became kind of like this big... big scandal, not because of the show exactly, but because of Kim Kardashian wearing Marilyn Monroe, which is very political dress, right? The happy birthday, the nude dress, which has a lot of issues with, you know, Kim Kardashian wearing that dress, but the dress itself has very political meaning. So what does it mean when Kim Kardashian wears Marilyn Monroe dress, right? So even if it's not political in terms of partisan politics necessarily, I mean, I think that the Met Gala, because of the attention it got, does allow people to make those statements through their clothes in ways that, again, this is a platform that maybe is certainly available only to the few and the rich. But they can kind of like harness it to make statements that are not necessarily connected to the exhibition, you know, itself or to the Met itself, but to kind of like a larger issues. I mean, you know, Ocasio-Cortez came with Eat the Rich dress. Representative Maloney came with kind of like the Equal Rights Amendment dress that was very, but again, I think, you know, thinking about bodies, thinking about trans rights, about gay rights, and you see a lot of camp, you see a lot of representation of those issues in a kind of like non-political way, which is the Met Gala, which allowed to put politics into it. In interesting ways.
It's a great combination, I think. And it really, for me, this is a great book to teach with, because it's one that students can easily relate to, because they, as you rightly pointed out, unless we're doing something wrong, everyone's wearing clothes. So it's a wonderful book, Aina. Thanks so much for joining the show and talking about fashion and politics.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thanks for listening. You can follow the Gilded Age and Progressive Era on Twitter or on my website, michaelpatrickcullinane.com. Please consider subscribing or reviewing the podcast wherever you listen, because it really makes a big difference and helps direct others to the show. I hope you'll join me again for the next episode.